So Healthy and Holy Conversations is trying something new. I want to thank Dr. Melba Sampson, my Sora. I was following her. I'm copying Restream. This is something I got just watching, paying attention to her work. And I knew I had to change my platform. So this is new and different. I actually like it. And my guest likes it tonight too. So we have the Reverend Dr. Beverly Wallace. If I call her Ma, that's because I call her that in her office, who is my Sora as well, and honored that she's on my platform. I have known her, oh my God, I've known her over a decade, and she's poured into me so much. And tonight we will be discussing her work around grief. So I invite people to chat, speak, say what they need to say, do what you need to do here, because grief is a very hard topic. So we are streaming to YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and to Twitter. So I got to learn how to do all of that in last week. And so those platforms, if you do watch the replay, please note that you watch replay. And for those of you who are present, please like it, love it, share it. And I will say that throughout. So Dr. Wallace, I asked for your bio because I put him on my website. Mm-hmm. But in the conversation, let the people know what you want them to know.
Well, good evening, all. I am delighted to be with my dear Sara, my former student, who teaches her professor on a regular basis how to be. I am so delighted that she invited me into this space that we can talk about grief and loss. Currently, I'm an associate professor of congregational care at Luther Seminary that's located in St. Paul, Minnesota, where right now it's minus 35 degrees. I'm so grateful that I'm here in Atlanta, where it's not that cold, and being around folks who are interested in this topic of grief and loss, though I'm going to veer off into something else pretty soon, something that's more lighter conversation. But I'm here and grateful for this opportunity to be in conversation with you, Sara Margaret.
Mm-hmm. I muted myself. This is me learning. So tonight, I wanted to go fix some features too. So for those who are coming in as they do, again, we're talking. I'm glad you said we will move to something lighter. I don't want people to just sit. I found over time, Dr. Wallace, even sitting with you and learning, busting into your office at ITC, like asking questions, I was like, okay, this is blowing my mind. As I found over time, and I don't know if you did know, while I was at ITC, my grandmother passed away. So I was like, I know the people I busted into your office, it was a reason. I was like, I can't grab why. Mm-hmm. But I found through the connections I made that grief wasn't a finality. It didn't mean that it was no more. And I realized it was a transition. And how was I going to make meaning? Your book even speaks to that. How am I going to make meaning now of this? What am I going to do with my grief? And I saw grief for the first time as an emotional space. I was like, no, it's a thing to do. But you invited me to see, no, it's an emotion to experience. And so with that, that was a lot, because I was like, what do you mean? And so what are you going to do with the gift your grandmother left you? And so that was a question you asked me in your office. So you did know. You asked me, like, what are you going to do with the gift your grandmother left you? And I said, what gift? That was like, she didn't leave me nothing. But over time, I have realized that, you know, what I needed to do with this gift is, you know, what knowledge that she leave me with. And it's this: touching community. My grandmother was a communal person. If she cooked, she cooked for everybody. If she did anything, she did it for everybody. And so this gift I can give back is this for everyone. So
reclaiming that again, reclaiming, really excited about the topic of communal grief, because historically, that's what we've done. It was a community that held us. Dr. Melba Sampson, Al Sora, always, you know, quotes Dr. Itiari Torre, you know, having the community to strong enough to hold us, you know, even hold us when we grieve. And often, and so the book that you're, you know, that I've written, co-wrote with my, when I was doing my PhD work with Dr. Paul Rosenblatt on African-American grief, the impetus of that was that oftentimes we don't hear the stories of persons about their grief experience. And so the book told the stories. And one of the learnings from that was that oftentimes people don't are not given permission, particularly African-Americans. We are not given permission to grieve, even though historically it was our community that held us in our sense of loss, of whatever the loss was. And so that we could, as I think your other person who speak to, you know, tonight talks about, so that we can mourn, we can moan, we can cry, we can yell and scream, and it would be okay, because it was a release of something, something sacred, something that has been lost to us. Because like your grandmother, she was, I mean, she was important to you.
Yes, she was. she was. You asked me something backstage, so I'm just going to put it out. You know, she became like life, and it wasn't perfected, but it was what I modeled. Like, you know, this is who I know. And so we really had, I did have to redefine what, again, like I said earlier, you know, what is grief? And so, you know, I guess my question tonight, because you asked me that question, but back in what you just described, how can Black people experience grief without it being defined? Because I don't think, like you said, we haven't had an opportunity to define it for ourselves.
Well, I think we do grieve. It's the matter of the manner of within which we do define that. You know, I think that we sometimes hold back those feelings, those emotions. But I do think that we do grieve, and it comes out in interesting ways. And so defining it is, I mean, is that the most important part of the work that we have to do for our own healing, for our own wholeness, for our own embracing our who we be, our humanity? It's within us. I mean, we have lots of things to grieve. The whole legacy, you know, the transatlantic slave, you know, voyage, and the remnants of that, that's still within our bodies. We grieve that, you know, whether we articulate it or not, whether or not we know it or not, we still grieve.
Wow. Wow. I guess kind of just sitting right there for just a moment. Mm-hmm. And there's a piece in your book that speaks about racism and grief. Mm-hmm. Some people say grieving while Black. Bashir Wade, I'll put my books up, but there's, you know, but there's a piece of the medical piece in where people are grieving. They don't even realize that they're seeing this death is because I am Black. Not I died in a Black body. I loved reading that piece. But I literally died because I am Black. Mm-hmm. Can we speak to that for a while? Because this is still this middle passage experience of the lack of importance for my body.
Mm-hmm. It was historical. I mean, I'm thinking about my mother, you know, when she was a little girl and she had polio, and the fact that she couldn't get the treatment as soon as another little white girl and maybe a mile down the way because of her Black body. But the same thing happened just recently with the whole COVID experience. I mean, that experience. I mean, the whole, it's the same thing. How were people treated? You know, what we are the hospitals that allow for persons to go to get the care that they needed. We know from research that some doctors don't want to touch the body of Black bodies. And so all of that plays a part in how we die.
Wow.
Because of the hue of our skin.
Sometimes we do have to pause in a healthy, holy conversation. These are hard conversations. And they're normally conversations that are not invited due to white supremacy. Because it really is the argument of the conversation. It's hard. And so, and it isn't a matter of agreeing right here. It is a matter of seeing right here. Like, because of the color of your skin, you're not worth living. And we're experiencing that. We did see it in COVID. We saw an elevated number of African Americans who died.
Yes.
Because they didn't have access.
Right.
And we were like, everybody could get to the hospital. Everybody had access to vaccine. Not at first. We saw all, you remember all of the people who got it. Our community was dying.
Right.
And dying while Black. Food deserts, for instance. We're dying because of malnutrition, because we have places that don't have access to healthy food. Once again, looking at it from a middle passage situation, like you didn't have access. We made that food work. We made it a delicacy. All we had.
But I'm going to go back to definition. So when we're talking about dying, I mean, are we talking about the physical dying, or, I mean, there's many ways to die, the emotional pieces around our death. And do we grieve those pieces too?
Can we define at least two? Like, I know we know physical, but I wonder, can we define emotional death? Because that was the urgency of this conversation. We're moving into a brand new year. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we've had time to talk about emotional death. We just picked right back up in our Black bodies and just kept going.
No. And it's hard. I'm addicted to MSNBC. And so I'm watching and listening to what is going on around us in this country. I mean, that's continuing to kill us. I mean, emotionally, psychologically, physically, you know, financially, all of those losses. And so, you know, when I talk about grief, I also talk about losses. What are those losses that we experience? I mean, it's, some of them is the loss of the freedom to read what we want to read in some contexts, the loss of generations who are not going to have the education that they need. I mean, what are the losses, and how then do we grieve it? And then how do we respond to those losses? And I think that's what you're talking about. Yeah. How then does the community respond to those losses, which is, I guess, a manifestation of the grief process itself. So again, grief, I mean, can cover a whole lot of losses. Question is, what do we do as a community? And I think that's what you're asking.
Yes. So we'll just stick with that emotional space, emotional loss of the inability to read things. There were particular books on the banned list that I'm sitting here like, I read those that I recently read. I'm like, seriously? Particular access to community, even watching the restructure of pieces of our community, and we have not grieved them. So, you know, Dr. Wallace, how would you invite us to, even beyond your work, how would you invite us to grieve and move? Because we're good at moving. Black people know how to move. We know how to just act like it didn't happen and move, or act like it did happen and just can't do anything about it. But
Well, I think we're going to have to pause and acknowledge those losses that we have. I mean, and then again, having the community that's going to be with us as we grieve. I mean, I'm loving the fact that soon we're coming up to Kwanzaa. I mean, so that's a community opportunity where we can talk about those things that were in the past that have that we are grieving, or we should grieve, or could grieve if we knew that the company that we kept, the families that are around us, the community that surround us will be there for us. Because that's the hard part. We're afraid that who's going to be there with us when we fall apart?
Whoa. That So I mean, again, what are those pause moments? So emotional grief, we have a lot of people, they do not encourage that we look at it as a victim space, but Black people have been victims. We have been repressed, and it leads to this depressed space. And so how do we, in our Black bodies, move into trust through this grief? Because we don't trust each other, which what you just offered was a Sankofa moment. What you just offered was a Black principle moment to look back and bring forward and do it together. I don't know if we know how to pull that level of trust forward.
But do we know the history? Do we know about Sankofa? Do we know the power of Sankofa, and what does that mean for our community? One of the communities that I've been involved with is the Association of Black Psychologists and their emotional emancipation program that they have, where there we defy the lie by telling the truth of who we are. And so if we don't know the truth of and the necessity of going back and reclaiming, looking, revisiting that was in the past, and to bring it back to the, you know, to where we are, so that we can move forward, then we're going to be stuck. To recognize the pain of the Ma'afa, to recognize that we were something more even before the slave trade, to recognize the power that we have.
Wow.
That often is dismissed because some people don't think that we're worthy. And, you know, we experience that in almost every place, in your jobs, in your school, wherever. And sometimes even in your own family.
Yes.
So, yes. Again.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, we have some comments. I'm going to put some up. And that's one I'm going to say for last, because we're going to move into that. But Lee Smith, this is my dear friend, social worker, because you've been reading. Yeah, so people need to understand that grieving may not be pretty, and people can read the rest, but it is not. But it doesn't.
And it's okay that it's not pretty.
Yes, it is okay that it's not pretty. That it is okay. And I don't know if Westernized society has put us in a space to where grief has to have a pretty aesthetic. Even in physical grief, we want to make sure that it's a beautiful funeral. And I taught Black for a minute. She looked like herself when we like, she's looking good in the cat. I mean, you know, so somehow we needed to have a beautiful aesthetic, when really it doesn't have to be beautiful. It can be painful. And Dr. Tammy's coming on, so she can back up the statement I'm about to make. And whenever she's ready, she'll give me a head nod, and she'll come right in. But there, she says it in her book, we can know that grief is ugly and we can still find happiness in this grief. You know, and so when she is ready, we're gonna bring her on. She can speak to it.
Hey. Can y'all hear me?
We can. Absolutely. We can. I know the weather is crazy, and I was worried. I was going to text you one more time, so I'm glad that you're here.
No, I was going to be using my phone, but okay. It's the browser wasn't supported, so I had to rush home to get to my laptop.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. This is me trying something new, but welcome.
Thank you.
Everybody, welcome, Dr. Tammy Isaac. I just paraphrased some of her books. So I brought her right in speaking to someone who made a comment, and just to shorten his comment, that grief isn't pretty. And you say that, you literally say that in your introduction, you invite us to a space where if the church has to grieve, we have to acknowledge that it's not going to be pretty, but we can find happiness in our grief. Can you explain a little bit about that?
For me, walking through my grief, what I learned, you know, I have experienced death before, but I think my most traumatic death was actually my mom. And it was, one, because she was my mom; two, because she died here in this house; three, it was my birthday. So it was very difficult. It was very hard, but I have seen some beautiful things transpire along the course of my grief, still yet painful. And I'll give you an example. One of those things for me was I was working in full-time ministry. I was an associate pastor on staff, but I had to step back to say, I need to deal with me, because what I'm dealing with right now, this grief, it's a little more than I'm able to handle, and nobody around me is capable of carrying the weight or the capacity of the emotions that I'm experiencing. Me stepping away from ministry was the hardest thing I could ever have done besides losing my mom. I absolutely love people. I love shepherding people. I love being right there in the trenches with them. So I wept for months. My mom's death, because I resigned, a month or two after she died. So now I'm grieving the loss of ministry. And I'm telling you, I had so many emotions. I had so-called heart issues. They thought I was having a heart attack. And it was so much. But me stepping out led way for God to open doors for me into the ministry of chaplaincy through hospice, not knowing that this was the ministry that God was calling me to all along. And I find so much peace and solace in what I do. And when I'm sitting by the bedside of people who are dying, it brings me much joy. Most people who don't work in hospice find hospice employees morbid, right? Because we have all these stories that we're sharing, right? right?
Sitting at a dinner table talking about death.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And walking away from a patient who has died or sitting there with that body, waiting for the funeral home to come and embracing the family, when I leave from there, there is such a fulfillment that I get from that. So what I mean is it took God used my grief experience to show me a more enlightening side of life that has brought me much fulfillment and joy that I think that I would not have been able to experience had I been stayed in the place that I was. So this is what, I forget his name. They call it finding meaning.
Yes.
God's name. I can't think about mm-hmm. it. I can't remember right now, but he talks about finding meaning, which means how do I live in the world now without the loved one that I've lost. And that's where you find happiness again, when you find meaning, when you're able to continue to move forward in life, and not without them, but with them, because now they are a part of you, right? We make stories, or they call it mosaics, right? Mm-hmm. We create these stories in our lives by being influenced by other people. So all that I am is because of my mother, what she's instilled in me. So I move forward in this life with her inside of me, mm-hmm. right? Does that make sense? So every person that you encounter in life leaves an impression on you. And it causes a shift in who you are and creates this new person. That's why we're growing every day to be this new person that we are every day. Each time that we learn something, each time that we come in contact with somebody different, each time we visit a different country and learn a different culture, you become an even more better person. I shouldn't say better, but you become more knowledgeable, more aware of just the life 30-mile radius life that some of us
That's the thing. That's how you jumped in and like recapped everything. And I know you didn't know that. Literally. Okay. No, you did wonderful. And David Kessler, who worked with Kubler-Ross, he wrote the book Finding Meaning. And Dr. Wallace in her book. I know y'all haven't met, so I think it's amazing. I love.
Well, look, I ordered it.
Okay, so she has.
I'm ready.
So in her book, she too talks about finding meaning after death because of how the book is set up. She's speaking about how African Americans grieve in different ways.
Yeah.
We have to find it. And so you came right in and like literally recap and stated the position awesome. Because what does it look like? Like you didn't have a community degree with you either, which gave us a body of work. Your book is amazing. So even you didn't have, you had to leave a place that you love. They couldn't grieve with you. Like so here's this, why can't the church grieve with me? Like I lost my mom and I have to go into a place that is for people, they think it's morbid, but no, this is where I had to learn how to do it different, and it caused me to grow. And like, what does that look like for others? Because again, grief doesn't have to be pretty. Matter of fact, grief can be snotty nose ugly, because grief has the cycle. So for both of you, I'm gonna put up with what Dr. LaFleur, hello, Dr. Richard, said. Most of us emotionally disconnect from each other as a result of the past. So now moving into, we were talking about the emotional death of Black people and the urgency of this conversation, because Dr. Isaac, we are moving into 2023 and we have not communally grieved 2020.
Right.
No, we
have not. I was thinking about this today, and I haven't read your book yet, Dr. Wallace, but I do plan on reading it. And I'm not sure how far in depth you go with the African American grief, but I was just pondering today that I feel we don't give ourselves permission to grieve, but others don't give us also that permission to grieve, right? Correct. And I think it's Dr. Mark Brackett who talks about permission to grieve. And it's basically the way that we've been raised to say, it's like unspoken, like you know you ain't supposed to cry because you don't want nobody to say nothing. And then if you do cry, then you get a whooping for crying. But and then also we don't have emotional intelligence. So sometimes the kid may be disappointed, but you think he angry. And so instead of dealing with his disappointment by talking to him, you whoop him because you think he mad. And then I thought about, well, when you go back down in the history and you go back down to our ancestors and those who were slaves and the poverty that we went through, then you go through the era where we weren't able to vote, the summer of 1964, you start thinking about all of that. I feel like the African American has been grieving since slavery.
Yep.
And I think that our grief, we don't know we're grieving because we weren't allowed to show that. You had to put on a face and a strength so that you can make it through all the hell that you were going through by being on, you know, we on here talking about a white man, right?
You know, this is the platform where you can say it. Dr. Wallace is going to come right behind you. I see it. Like, it's an itch on her face. Like,
I was thinking about this today. Like, we have been grieving all our lives. And then you see people, you know, they want to call it the angry Black man or the angry Black woman. Well, she not angry. She grieving from what all the stuff that we've had to go through all of our lives. And you know what happens with prolonged grief? It turns into something else. And then people become, you know, overwhelmed. We get crazy. We start doing all kinds of crazy stuff and jacking folks up. You know, that's just, I mean, what do you think, Dr. Wallace?
Absolutely. I've gone to the Legacy Museum. If anyone has not gone to the Legacy Museum in Montgomery, Alabama, they need to.
I need to go.
There is there's an exhibit there that takes me out every single time.
Mm.
It's an exhibit of two little kids calling for their mom and their dad. Mm. This is a period where, you know, enslavement. Where's my mom? Mm. Where's my dad? Where's my mom? Where's my dad? And over and over and over again. And so imagine the grief that it's within their bodies.
Yeah.
From the loss of a mother. I mean, during the slave trade, I mean, how many families were separated and torn apart?
Yeah.
And so we know, you know, using, you know, some science, epigenetics, we know that it's still within our bodies. those experience from then is still within us. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we are grieving, as one of my colleagues, Lee Butler, talks about. It's not post-traumatic slave, it's protracted slave syndrome that we're dealing with on a regular basis.
Every day.
Every single day. And so the question, so I was curious when Margaret asked, why can't Black folks grieve? Well, I do think that we are grieving. Yeah. I mean, that's what you're saying. We are ancestral grief, absolutely. We are grieving, but it shows itself in a variety of ways. And also, and as you said before too, sometimes we're not given permission.
Mm-hmm.
Have to be that strong Black woman. Shaniqua Walken Barnes and some others are saying, hey, we may be SBWs in recovery, because we've got to get over the fact that we have to hold up the world for everyone.
Yeah.
And not allow ourselves to grieve. Is, I mean, what does it do to one's body?
Right.
What does it do? I'm so glad that segmented perfectly, Dr. Wallace, because Dr. Isaac has in her book, she talks about the wailing women. Like, I read that part and I cried.
Wow.
Because we don't see many people write it in a book. That women carry the weight
mm-hmm.
of the community, and we don't see it in a book from the biblical standpoint, in that they carried the weight when Jesus, the women ministered to Jesus while he was dying. Like, oh my God, who is this woman that decided to put this in a book? Because that's not what we do in the Black church. We don't even talk about it. I grew up in the Baptist Black church in the South.
I did too.
So what you don't do is talk about women ministering in that aspect. We just gloss right over that. Like, they didn't do anything. We talk about Simon carrying the cross. We'll talk about all of that. But we don't talk about how the women wailed.
They bared the burden.
Yes. So what does that look like? Because an SBW, Strong Black Woman Syndrome, is real. Y'all go get Shaniqua Walken Barnes' book. Y'all got several, but go get that one. Y'all need it. Y'all thank me later. But that heaviness that we carry, and we argue about the heaviness. We will fight you when you tell us that, and first of all, you might hear soften, but when we let go of the weight so you can see you, you'll find Black women want to fight you. Like, that's fine, I own it. And so how are we moving through? Because again, moving into 2023, I'm praying that we can see these levels of grief, and that we realize that we are grieving. So why can't Black?
Well, that's the point. We don't know that we are grieving. And if we do, we have not been able to vocally voice that, right? Because for some reason, there's a shame in saying that I'm grieving. There's a shame to say, or to be seen crying, or we got to just hold it together for everybody else around us, like, especially in the church. So, you know, and for me, I wasn't a big crier. I was just like, you know, let's work it out. Let's get it done, you know. But I learned that, girl, you got the grief. My physician's assistant, when I went to the doctor, because I was like, something doesn't feel right. I feel weird. And I'm having, you know, my chest is beating hard. And, you know, she did this whole workup and physical. And she was like, your numbers are really great. Actually above, like, you're more healthier than most patients that come through here. I really think you just need to cry. I said, huh? And she literally held me.
Wow.
And let me cry on her shoulder. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized, you know what? Girl, you grieving. You're not as strong as you think you are. So sometimes it's hard for us to identify that this is really what I'm feeling. And then I
would have to be strong, though.
No.
Okay.
No.
Because one of the things you said was that you're not as strong as you think you are. And so.
Okay.
And so with that, it was a sense that you have to the
opportunity. I was thinking I would. I was thinking I had to be.
Yes.
Right? I was really thinking, okay, I need to be strong. I need to keep it together, you know, for my siblings. I needed to keep it together because of the people who are around me, who I felt ashamed of allowing them to know that I was feeling weak, that I was feeling down, that I couldn't make it through this because of the perception that I believe they had of me, mm-hmm. right? And when you live out of that perception of what other people, or you think other people are thinking of you, then, you know, I was heading down a downward spiral. So you're right. Like, I was thinking I needed to be strong, but there was no need to be strong at that moment. It was to just embrace. One of the things I do encourage is to embrace what you're feeling and to get to the point of identifying what you're feeling and why you're feeling that. And so, because I wasn't around people to help me identify what I was feeling, to actually just come up to me and say, Tammy, you're grieving. Tammy, you need to take some time off. It was more or less people was like, and this is why I left ministry. It was like, you know, you haven't done this and you ain't did this. I need this done or whatever. I mean, the day my mom died, I was getting texts from people about what to do in service.
Ooh,
I was texting people from home.
Yeah.
And I think when we don't recognize that we need to grieve, then nobody else is going to recognize that as either. So how can we grieve together if we don't even know how to grieve individually?
Well, and I think part of that, too, I remember when I was a chaplain at the Children's Hospital and at Emory, there was a young woman who had lupus. And so the doctor didn't know. And she had said, I am not having any more biopsies. Not going to do that. And so, of course, they called the chaplain and say, you know, help us get her to do what we want her to do. Well, I remember a couple of years later that I diagrammed that. What were the systems in place that would not allow her to articulate her own needs, her own truth, her own experiences of the loss of, you know, of that freedom, because mm-hmm. that's a loss too, mm-hmm. to make a decision about her own body.
Wow.
You know, and so there's systems in place that often keep us, hey, we have to act a particular way because it benefits the system.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about, you know, I'm talking about it could be a family system.
Yeah.
It could be a hospital system. It could be any other kind of system. You know about homeostasis, and it got to keep that balance.
Yeah.
And so someone being strong or feeling like they need to be strong keeps everyone else, hey, I don't have to worry about her because she's going to be okay when she's
And
not.
You know what? Somebody actually said that to me. When the moment that I tried to be vulnerable and say, hey, I really need y'all to pray for me, one member of the prayer team said to me, oh, I'm not worried about you. You'll be fine.
Oh, can we segue? Because we had a comment. And the comment, I want to honor this brother. And I'm going to ask this. And I'm going to ask the second one because I really need people who write about grief, y'all really, you don't have to have the answer. It's something I found out about grief. It isn't about having the answer. It really is about being present.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, you seldom hear about men talking about grieving and handling it. And so here, and we're listening how the invite, when you said a man from the team said, I'm not worried. Like, how do we invite Black men? And I'm going to come back and ask the same question about other areas of Black. But for Black men, how do we bring this invite? How do we do it?
Well, part of it is, again, what's the image that we, again, we're part of that his system too. What's the image that we have of a Black man or even a Black boy who cries?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a 2-year-old little boy, and don't get me started with this. And he cries. And what does someone say? Stop being, you know, a little girl, or stop being a sissy or something like that. Be a man.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes. And so men grow up with a sense that they can't be emotional.
Yeah.
And so we reinforce that too. So what happens when a man is emotional? Do we give him space to cry? What he will probably do, and this is from the stories in the book that, you know, that I've co-authored, is that he'll find another space, in public.
Right.
And I found even Black males who are grieving, Black male identifying individuals, period, will find another space to grieve and grieve with something. And I mean that. They grieve with food. They grieve with drugs and alcohol. They grieve.
We do it too.
And we do too. Mm-hmm. But here is this separation within us that we will put that on the man. And women start, we start picking up more tasks, and then we move into our spaces and we still grieve with.
Right.
We grieve with another human body. We grieve with.
Right.
So we don't come together for communal grief. We literally separate in our
grief. We're not teaching it. And so when going back to the wailing women, this was a historic thing. This was something that they did from one generation to the next. That's why they say call for the wailing women, and then they further down it tells them to teach your daughters to wail as well. And so this is something generational that we should be teaching. And then I believe that the way that we raise our children, male or female, they begin to learn how to wail. So when it says to call for the wailing women, let them wail and let them wail until there's tears falling down, because the wailing women were not just the only ones wailing, they were leading the wail.
Whoa, that's it.
That was their goal. There was a segment of people, of women, whose that was their job for the sake of the community.
Absolutely.
They were the ones that they were called on. Like you said, they were called on. We call on the wailing women. That was their vocation. That was their call. Yeah. That was their purpose. And I think, you know, historically, there have been different roles for different, you know, segments of our community.
Yeah.
And again, it was not every woman.
No.
But it was a particular group of women that were called on to do that job, because we had to grieve. There was an understanding that the grief process had to happen, and someone had to acknowledge the loss of, you know, someone in the community that had value.
Right.
Go ahead. I was going to say they were leading the cry. That kind of just got
right.
me. They were leading to gave permission for everyone.
Right. So they basically took charge of this is what we should be doing now. So, you know, even when I was doing the research and studying, it was like, because the people didn't know that this was something that they needed to be doing. Right. They didn't realize, okay, God is coming and judgment is coming. So we need to start wailing now so that we can have this preferable outcome of, you know, God's healing in the land. But this is going to happen. And so these women represented, this is what you should be doing. So what they were doing is teaching people how to wail, how to respond to something traumatic, something that it is lost that they've loved, which included the entire community. So even though, like, there were only, just like there are certain grief counselors, there are certain Christian counselors, right? We lead the way. We take the charge, just like the wailing women, and we wail until, the Bible says, until their eyes were filled with water, right? Until the whole community began to weep and wail. And so I believe that that's how we engage not just the men, but the women, the children, every Black person, right? We engage them when us who know how to identify grief, who knows how to, who understands that this is a time that we need to be calling out, right? For God are releasing the sounds that are in our bellies, right? Mm-hmm. We need to rise up, myself, Dr. Wallace, Reverend Conley, and everybody else on here who has an understanding of grief. And when we show our vulnerability and go before the people and be honest about what we're feeling and what we are experiencing, we now become the wailing women. Absolutely. And we will keep pushing forward until their eyes well up and they begin to say, I need help.
Okay, we take pauses with Healthy and Holy. Because I know I was a preacher.
I know, I felt it. I was like, let me come.
She's preaching. She's preaching.
And oh my God. So in a segment, it's to their eyes. Mm-hmm. Because there were other pieces of population of Black community, our LGBTQ population. Literally, once again, bodies in Black. Now we have this double space with them. Like, not only are you Black, but you gay. So you can go down too. And then our children, like, yeah. Oh, well, children can't get COVID. Children can't really get sick. It's almost like you'll be all right about your grief. And then we started to watch as we started to lose. And we see how in 2 years, 3 years, we watched these populations start to try to figure out, like, okay, how do we fit back into Black population? Mm-hmm. Because we got separated out, including our children. Mm-hmm. So LGBTQ population, they have been known for years. You know, we have been known to just, you know, we're going to make our own houses. We're going to do that. But what does it look like when we sit and include them into our grief? Because that's historical too. And then, because I'm looking at our time, I am double questioning. How do we bring our children into grief? Because Atlanta has experienced some, well, not even Atlanta. I think the United States has just watched as children have been killed in the last 3 months just for being outside. Like, literally, they're outside doing whatever they're doing, die, and they are hit or something, and we're moving past it. We're trying to create. So how's that looking? Double question, but I'm looking at time.
Okay. I'm watching my time too because I'm holding my thing that's a go up. So this January, I'm teaching a course entitled Human Sexuality in the Christian Church. Okay. Mm-hmm. Going to do a Sankofa move again. We've got to know the history of our LGBTQ community and that it's not new.
Right.
It is not new. And so if we start to reclaim that history, our history, mm-hmm. that goes back beyond before Paul or, you know, anything that's been written or codified in this, what's called the sacred text, then when we reclaim who we've always been.
Yeah.
And then that's when the healing will take place. Wow. As far as our children too, we're going to have to, to find ways of telling them a true story.
Dr. Wireless, y'all trying to tune up at the end?
A true story of who they've been. Mm-hmm. And that, and then again, claim the community where we don't say, hey, at one time, I remember my parents, you know, lived in a community. My aunt, who was not my aunt, could whoop me if I was misbehaving. Nowadays, we've embraced this individualistic way of being. And so again, yes, the community is so important for the healing of our children.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think we've gotten away from understanding what community is. And it's like now we're introducing community and helping us understand what different communities look like. I know for me, when I was in seminary, we talked about communities and how, like, just being a part of a running group, that's a community. Mm-hmm. And or being a part of a baseball team, that's a community. And that's sacred too, because there is this unspoken bond that you have that allows you to become vulnerable within that group. So when I talk about spiritual communities, of course, I'm talking about the church, but I'm also talking about the communities that you build with people, because that's spiritual as well. Because a lot of these communities that we are part of is healing for our souls. It brings joy for our souls, and it helps us in the process of whatever trauma or experience that we're having in the grief. So that's why it's important to have these communities. But like you were talking about, Dr. Wallace, we've become, you know, the African-American community is so broken off now into, you know, different communities that are getting smaller and smaller every day, that I don't even think that we look at each other as being the same, but we're looking at, you know, we're fighting each other. We're coming against each other. I'm trying to be better than you, or this group is that. I think that we have.
That's grief too. You know,
absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to reclaim love. We have to, what's that? Is it Bell, the author, who talks about Bell Hooks? Love?
Yes. Bell Hooks.
Yeah. Like, we've got to reclaim love, loving ourselves and loving each other and loving just where we are and having gratitude for how far we have come and what we do have. And then understanding that when we do things together in community, it makes us stronger. Even when I talk about, even in the book about communal grieving, that God grieves. And when it shows how Jeremiah grieved, Jeremiah's tears was the tears of God. And when God grieved and we grieve together in unison with God, that makes us stronger. So when we grieve with each other, I'm able to come through the process a little bit better than me just sticking in my corner saying I can't make it. And, you know, and a lot of this is stuff, not just that I research, but stuff that I literally went through because I didn't understand emotions, because I never was an emotional person. I would always say I'm emotionally detached. Like, none of that matters to me. Let's move on. Let me help you fix it, and then we can move on. But I'm telling you, I got in touch with my emotions when I went through this grief experience. And it's important for us to be able to, you know, become connected. And so I let aside my pride to say, hey, I went to the doctor, and this is what the doctor is saying. I need to cry. I'm depressed. I got some anxiety going on. They talking about putting me on medication. So we got to get together because I ain't getting on no medication. I was vulnerable to five to my siblings, and then to five people who were like mentors and encouragers for me to say, I need y'all to help me through this process, because I knew that I was not going to be able to make it through by myself. So I built a community where I could be vulnerable and not feel ashamed. And I think that a lot of us not sharing comes from shame, right? Yeah. We've shamed each other throughout the years. You don't have that, or you live over here. Your mama worked there. Y'all don't even have a job, you know? And, you know, you're just trying to make it through.
Yeah. But I don't want us to leave this conversation without talking about something that is right before us, that happened recently with suicide. Mm-hmm. Suicide within the African-American community. You know, because Margaret, you asked about our children. How are the children? Interesting question, interesting greeting for the children. When our children are suiciding, that's part of it is because of what the grief that they're experiencing. We probably don't even know all of what they're going through.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to acknowledge that our babies, our children are finding ways to get out of this world because the loss, whatever, the loss of dreams, the loss of being accepted for who they are, all of that is using Shaniqua Walker Barnes' title, it's too heavy a yoke for our babies to carry.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, you know, and maybe some others who have not dealt with whatever their emotional stuff has been, thinking about, you know, the brother who suicided, the dancer. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
We're going out, and it is not a white phenomena.
It's not.
No. No.
And you say that in the book, and I do want to give people that 5 minutes if they have questions. I can start putting them in. That it is not, white people aren't left out of this either. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer that white supremacy culture, it hurt everybody involved. That mm-hmm. I'm known for saying we were bathed in it, all of us. Mm-hmm. And so here we are, babies, you know, how the children, I know we learned that in school. I know, like, how are the children? How are the children? Like, they can't handle this anymore. Like, this is, mm-hmm. I don't want to be here. If it's got to be like this, I don't want to be here. So even to lighten the load of the sound of the use of suicide, is I'm unliving. And I hear mm-hmm. that among population when I'm in practice, I'm unliving. I don't, if this is what life is, I don't want to do it. And
you know,
it's too heavy.
And I was going to say too, because we don't model for our children and help them express what they're feeling and bring them into situations, because we try to protect them by keeping them out of the light of traumatic experiences. But one of the things I know I teach with my families, you know, they always have the option, but I do encourage, you know, bring your children in, let them be a part of this process of their loved one dying, because at the young age, they learn to express and deal with their emotions, but we've been covering them from those traumatic experiences. So when they get older and they deal with something like their own grief, they don't know how to handle it. Or when they get to an age where they start to get bullied and then they deal with all of these things at school, they don't know another way. So they rather leave this life because they don't know that eventually you can process those emotions.
And historically, children were involved in death rituals. You know, mm-hmm. that was part of what we had. But because we've used the medical model, you know, we hide death. We're not necessarily comfortable with death.
Right.
So then, of course, we're not teaching our children that death is part of the life cycle.
Absolutely.
So I would like for you guys to give some last words. And I and Dr. Wallace, I want to ask Dr. Isaac go first. And Dr. Wallace, there was something you didn't want us to leave, and I'm so glad you brought it in. There's also a space I feel like as an elder, and I'm big on this. If anybody watches Healthy Holy Conversations, I just believe our elders, and not elder in that you're old, elder in that this is the life walk. You know what I'm saying? Like the life walk you've had. And even saying, you know, this is a part of process. This is a part of our life process. And we're removing pieces of our process so people don't want to participate. Like, is this a part of it when it hasn't mm-hmm. been normalized? So tonight, as you guys give closing words, I wonder how we can bring the community with this conversation into normalizing this communal space of grieving, in that we do have a space where we moan. We have this well, but the well leads us to a mourning period. It's a guide to let everybody's tears come, to their tears show. And then bring us into a mourning space. Like, what does it look like when we move into a communal celebration?
You want me to go?
You can go. And then Dr. Wallace, yes.
Okay. So just to reiterate, like Dr. Wallace said, you know, identifying or bringing up about Twitch, some of the things I was taking some little notes earlier, just thinking about when we think about grief, a lot of times we think about it just for ourselves, right? But there is a communal grief, and that gives us, that opens the door and the opportunity for us to do it together. And I think innately we know how to do it, because there are times like when 9/11 happened and how everybody come together, right? Or when there's a mass shooting, then everybody, a part of that community comes. But it's not until we have this tragedy of something major that we learn to do that, because there are grieving moments that are happening within just like my neighborhood, right, which is my community, you know, and sometimes we, you know, oh, well, I don't know that person, so it doesn't matter to me. But there are so many opportunities for us to grieve together because we all, a lot of us love Twitch. A lot of us loved Kobe Bryant. It was a lot of people who was mourning that. Just the injustice that we go through as Black people, the racism. And instead of fighting each other, I think we need to find opportunities that we can share in our pain. To not be fearful of what we're going through, not be fearful of the pain and what we're dealing with, but to find people. I think groups like breast cancer awareness for survivors, I think groups like that are really good. It was really helpful for my mom to find people who were also dealing with the same types of tragedies. And I think when we can see other people going through the same things that we go through, then it helps us to lead into a place of vulnerability. And one of the main things, like in the church, when you have a pastor who just seems to be processing through and never really having any issues, it makes him look like he's floating like a little angel and he or she is just not having any experiences. But when you can identify with those that you lead in your community, then it helps them to know that, you know, oh, even that person have trauma, or that person have that, which opens the doorway. So I think if we continue to be more vulnerable, it opens a doorway for people to come in and to be a part of the space where they can also grieve together. And I think when we create these spaces, that we let people know that these spaces are sacred and what is shared in this space will stay in this space, so that they're not fearful of what they share in that space will get out to other people until they're at a point where they can share their own testimony or their own experience. But until people can find trust in what is happening, then they won't be able to be vulnerable in there. And the last thing I wrote this was communal grieving. It also offers that something that we really cannot get just by ourselves, right? There's a strength, you know, where there's two or three, right? A threefold cord is not easily broken. There's strength in numbers. And so when we can get together with somebody else who can help us bear, you know, the yoke or the trauma, the issue that we're going through, it helps to validate the pain that we are experiencing, helps us know that we're not crazy, and help us know that be able to heal and come through that process.
Thank you. And yeah. Dr. Wilder?
Okay, I'm going to be quick. Having more conversations like this is necessary. Mm-hmm. I also know that in my denomination, we have rituals such as Blue Christmas, where persons mm-hmm. get together to talk about their losses. I mean, oftentimes holidays like this bring about memories of loss. It was last year, this time, that a lot lost my mom. And so, you know, to have places and spaces created where people can grieve is necessary. So that's what I'm saying. Margaret, keep doing the work that you're doing, offer opportunities. Yeah, my battery is running low. And so for that, I'm going to say good night.
Good night. And thank you all. If you have to go, I do want to say thank you all for watching. Again, support Healthy and Holy Conversations. And I need from you all, y'all's Cash App. Y'all can DM me. So I can, it's a little, when I say a little bit of offering, because it's coming out of my pocket, it's enough for y'all to go get like a Happy Meal. it's a little offering. Dr. Irie Session time, she said, honey, you pour in who pour out, you know, with a little bit you got. And it has blessed me. And so mm-hmm. I honor that. But again, if y'all want to keep hearing Healthy Holy Conversations, y'all support. Send it to us. This is coming out of the budget. This is a budget item for my private practice, MLC Consulting LLC, that's located in Smyrna, Georgia, because these conversations are necessary for our healing. It isn't just the individual couch session, but who are we bringing to the table so we can have communal conversation that's healthy and holy. Again, thank you all tonight. If y'all want to talk about something different, y'all let me know. Y'all send it to me and we will.
Did they have any questions?
Yeah, they didn't have any. Y'all hit it hard. One person said that in the South, she remembered you would come to the house. And I remember when she said it too. And you would sit around and be.
Oh, yeah. And just be.
In this space and just be. My friend said in South Carolina, the dead body be sitting there.
Absolutely.
And you would be right there in memory.
Because then they used to call it the, Dr. Wallace, you might know when they used to, that's why they call it the was it the wake? Because they left the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So you, and so what does it look like emotionally when we sit and wait? Y'all talked about it tonight. And socially, when we said we need to create community that's coming, tribes didn't stand alone. They came back to community. And so, again, thank you all for this conversation. Y'all be safe wherever you are. I don't know who getting snowed in. I hope we don't in Atlanta.
But wherever you are, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Okay. No problem. I thank you for pouring into this space. Thank y'all for having a healthy and holy conversation. And I will see y'all next time.
All right. Good night.